From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, novelist, essayist, and high-voltage intellectual provocateur Gore Vidal does not believe the official story about what happened on 9/11. But then Gore Vidal doesn't believe the official story about most that's happened in the last half century of American life. Tonight on Point, Conspiracy, Gore Vidal and American Empire. But first, we begin with news on the federal budget. Today, President Bush submitted to Congress a $2.23 trillion budget he says has the ingredients to get the economy back on track while meeting social obligations and protecting the country from terrorist attack. Jonathan Wiseman is economic policy reporter with The Washington Post. I asked him to give us the headline on the Bush budget.
It's a very ambitious budget. Not only does it bring out record budget deficits in terms of actual dollars, $300 billion, but it also sets out a course of action for the government that is, even conservatives are just calling it radical. It's remarkable what he is trying to do in one fell swoop. You know, overhaul Medicare in a dramatic way, impose fairly stark caps and changes to the Medicaid program, create another $1.3 trillion in tax cuts. And what he is doing to the funding of the federal government has potentially dramatic impacts.
Impact immediately or down the road?
Down the road. For instance, the proposal to create these new savings accounts, the lifetime savings account.
This is for individual citizens.
Yes, for individuals, they could put money in, after-tax money into these accounts, $7,500 a year, withdraw them for any reason, and for any individual. So a family of four could put $30,000 a year away in one of these accounts and shield it from all capital gains taxes, all dividend taxes, all interest taxes. So for a vast majority of Americans, taxation on savings and investment would cease to exist.
The implications for the federal government?
In the short run, actually, they're counting this as a revenue gainer because they see people shifting money from traditional IRAs into these new accounts, these new retirement accounts, having them pay taxes now. And so in the short run, I think they're counting on $10 billion next year alone from these accounts.
That's because they would pay off the penalty with the IRA.
That's right. They would pay a tax penalty on from their IRA to the IRS, and then they would begin accruing the money tax-free. So you will see the cost of this become very clear not until way after the Bush administration has left office. On this account alone, from 2004 to 2008, they actually anticipate this change saving the government $14.8 billion in additional revenues to the government through 2008. But by 2013, things have gone negative, and then when the baby boomer generation starts retiring in earnest, this will be a very, very costly proposal.
So is this a budget that explicitly anticipates federal government deficits for years and years to come, or does it suggest that this spending and tax cuts will spark growth that will bring us back into the black?
Well, they do say that it will spark growth and new tax receipts, but if you look at their five-year window instead of a 10-year window, you do see deficits spiking up to $300 billion and then beginning to decline to $178 billion by 2007. But then you'll see in 2008, it goes back up to $190 billion. And if you did extend the window further, you would see the deficits actually increasing further, because that's when you start seeing the cost of their Medicare program and the cost of many of these tax programs.
So it's a big deficit budget and embraces that long term. Is there a rationale for that included with the budget submission?
Well, the rationale is that as far as the size of the economy, and this is absolutely true, as far as the size of the economy, these are not particularly huge budget deficits. They're not as big as the deficits of the 80s, not even as big as the deficits of the early 90s under the president's father. And the rationale is, look, if the government really wanted, if the Congress and the White House really wanted to get rid of these deficits and really kind of put their nose to the grindstone, they could get rid of them. These aren't so big.
By increasing taxes or by cutting government services?
Well, of course, they would say by cutting government.
I see.
But they say by right now, given the war on terrorism, given the prospects of war in Iraq, given the economic circumstances, there would be no reason to do this, and nor do they see any reason to do this for the rest of the Bush term.
Jonathan Wiseman, looking across departments, who are the winners, who are the losers?
Well, of course, the big winners are the Department of Defense and the new Department of Homeland Security. The losers, the Department of Agriculture, it has a hard freeze, and many of their programs are going to be cut.
Wasn't there just a big increase in spending on ag subsidies voted in last year?
Yes.
Are they stepping back on that, or are they maintaining it?
It's hard to tell. I mean, I would think that they have made the statement that funding that is authorized is not necessarily what they're going to give. So they may be stepping back. It's too early to tell.
Can't tell right now, but ag is a loser. What else?
The Department of Housing and Urban Development will have almost a freeze. The Department of Interior is basically frozen. The Justice Department actually gets cut. In part, some of these Clinton-era programs, like the COPS program, which gave direct aid to local law enforcement, that's being cut back. Department of Labor is cut back with significant cuts to some vocational training and education programs.
Environmental Protection?
EPA gets cut, too. It's stuck at $7.6 billion. But if you look within, you know, within that budget, there are cuts to clean water grants to the states and water infrastructure programs.
And what about first responders on the security front? Last year there was money frozen, I guess, that was never delivered for police, firefighters, emergency medical. Is that included in this budget?
Yes. The Department of Homeland Security and Homeland Security in general gets the largest percentage increase. And as you said, it is difficult to figure this all out because they are basing those increases on the president's 2003 request because the Congress hasn't finished the 2003 budget.
So how much may this change before it's all over, Jonathan Weissman?
As one senior Republican aide told me, look, if there's a war breaking out next month, this whole budget's going to be set aside. If war breaks out in March, they're going to be starting from square one.
We understand that currently there is nothing allotted in this budget for the cost of a war with Iraq.
That's right. And I have to say that that's probably right. I mean, how can you budget for a war that ostensibly you're trying to avoid?
Jonathan Weissman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Weissman is economic policy reporter with The Washington Post. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. Wars are to be made on nations, not on rootless gangs of terrorists, says Gore Vidal. So why is the United States at war on terror? Therein, says Vidal, lies the tale of Republican ideals subverted by imperial ambitions of oil and power and presumption of American mythology so deep and damaging we no longer see it. His tongue is sharp, his memory is long, and now the irrepressible contrarian intellect of Gore Vidal is focused on what he calls the Cheney-Bush junta. Have we lost the American Republic in a dream of American empire? Does Gore Vidal make your blood boil at him or at the towering powers that be? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Gore Vidal, author of 22 novels and more than 200 essays. His latest book is entitled Dreaming War, Blood for Oil and the Cheney-Bush Junta. Good evening and welcome, Gore Vidal.
Good evening.
Good evening. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Hello, Jack.
Gore Vidal, you have written that, I guess you did in the year 2000, and it's included in your new collection of essays, that our subject is the serious distortion of the truth on our side, and why, quoting you, unless they are straightened out, we are forever doomed to thrash about in a permanent, uncomprehending fog. You wrote that before 9/11, but you seem to be applying the same kind of skeptical eye to the widely accepted kind of official story of what happened on 9/11. What's your story? What do you think happened?
Well, my story is told in some detail in this little book called Dreaming War. Mm-hmm. I go into great detail on what was not done and done at 9/11 by the president, by the military. You know, the president swears an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. I believe that Mr. Bush did none of these things, and he certainly did not preserve, protect, and defend the United States. And all the evidence is there. I've got it from many, many sources, none of them secret. My main source is usually the Wall Street Journal, so you see I don't really go in for a very radical
that flaming sources. Revolutionary rag.
Red it may be, but that's R-E-A-D.
Yes.
I want to start this, since I went to Exeter in New Hampshire, and I've spent a lot of time in New England, so I speak to, really in a sense, fellow New Englanders. And I'm going to quote a couple of sentences, don't get upset, from one of New England's greatest sons, John Quincy Adams.
We're happy to have you do it. Go Vidal.
Good. In July 4th, in the 1820s, he was asked, should the United States join a consortium of nations to free Greece from Turkey? Hmm. And he was a classicist, and he loved Greece and ancient Greece and Greek culture. But he said no, under no circumstances would we be helpful in a war against Turkey to free Greece. And this is the exact quote from John Quincy Adams. Mm-hmm. The United States goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is a well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. If the United States took up all foreign affairs, it would become entangled in all the wars of interest and intrigue which assume the colors and usurp the standard of freedom. She might become the dictatress of the world. She would be no longer the ruler of her own spirit. I speak in the tradition of Mr. Adams.
Have we arrived at that point?
Yes, we have.
Dictatress of the world, no longer the ruler of the American spirit. What does that last mean?
Well, I would say the core of the American spirit, if you can concentrate it to one thing, would be the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Or, if you want to be more pedestrian, let's go to President Coolidge, who said the business of America is business. I go right along with that. Nothing wrong with that. It's not very glamorous. But imperialism has always gone against the American grain, even though we have indulged in it from time to time. That's in 1846 when we picked a war with Mexico so that we could steal California from them. We have done these evil things, and evil has generally befallen us. General Ulysses Grant was a young lieutenant during the Mexican War, and he said later, after he had won the war for the Union, he said, I always thought, after I was down there in Mexico and seeing what we were doing to a poor and weaker country in order to grab territory, I have always felt that nations, like individuals, must suffer the judgment of God. And I thought the judgment of God was upon us when the Civil War began, that was our retribution for what we had done to a weaker neighbor.
Was the judgment of God upon the United States on September 11th, 2001?
It depends on which God we're looking at. I would say that we had done enough things, obviously, to exasperate a bunch of what seemed to me to be religious maniacs and not a country. This is why we can't have a war on terror. It's like having a war on dandruff, you know. Nobody likes it. We might try to cure all the dandruff in the world. But it's not worthy of a war. These were gangsters who hit us, even though they used religious language.
Gore Vidal, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're going to come back and look at the details of your picture of what happened pre-9/11. Jack Beatty, there's a conspiracy described by Gore Vidal here that is far from the standard understanding of September 11th.
And yet, in the larger picture of what's happened to American history, I think he speaks out of the feeling that many Americans have had that our history has been hijacked, that we had been thrust into affairs and complications for which we were unprepared and which we little comprehend. He quotes Dean Acheson right after World War II, saying to get us into the Cold War, you had to make things even clearer than truth. Well, we've been seeing the world that way for a long time and reluctantly led into it, I think.
Clearer than truth tonight with Gore Vidal, talking about the fate of the American Republic. Gore Vidal sees not blunder but design in 9/11, a plot, a conspiracy. Do you buy that? Was 9/11 all about oil and Afghan pipelines? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Gore Vidal about the fate of the American Republic and Gore Vidal's interpretation of September 11th, 2001, where he sees not blunder but design, a plot, a conspiracy. Do you buy that? Could it be that 9/11 was Osama bin Laden's preemptive war on America, that America knew it was coming? And have American elites been pushing the country into war and empire for most of a century? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Gore Vidal, I want to be sure that people understand what you're suggesting, and of course you deliver it in more detail in the book, but as I understand from reading your book, Dreaming War, you're saying an attack on Afghanistan was planned well before the attack that came after 9/11, that the Bush administration knew that 9/11 was coming and did not stop it, that this was all about the desire to get Central Asian oil out across via pipeline across Afghanistan, that it's all about oil and power. Is that a fair summary?
It's a fair summary, which you have carefully put into language which is not acceptable to your listeners, that I favor a conspiracy. We all know that there are no conspiracies in American life, unless it's Enron and Anderson.
Well, I make a distinction between conspiracy theory and a conspiracy. There is, of course, such a thing as a conspiracy, but we note that you say in your book the media doesn't accept conspiracies, yet it's a word with a definition, with a meaning.
Yes, but it's not quite the right one here.
All right.
I've changed the word, which I thought I had done in a rather light and amusing way. I said, since we're not allowed to say anything is a conspiracy, the fact that the president is Enron Oil, his father, a former president, is Carlyle Group, the vice president is Halliburton, a huge oil concern. Condoleezza Rice is Texaco Amoco. The Secretary of the Interior is British Petroleum. All the great offices of state are occupied by gas and oil people, and the first thing this administration does is intervene in the Middle East around the oil fields. Since we cannot say that this government is a conspiracy, I've changed the word so we don't use it anymore. We're going to say coincidence. It is a coincidence that all the great offices of state are occupied by people with vast interests in oil, and are damn well going to use the force of the United States to get it for us and for them. That, to me, is a shocker and worth investigation.
But call it what you will, are you saying that the Bush administration knew that there were going to be hijacked planes used as missiles on American targets and deliberately let it happen so that they would have cause for an attack on Afghanistan?
Well, how would I know this? I'm not part of the administration.
Well, it's the suggestion that I came away from your book with.
Well, I'm glad you began to put the dots together. The Clinton administration had prepared a strike against Afghanistan, against the Taliban, whom they had found hopeless, and they had made deals with them to get a pipeline for UNICAL, et cetera, to take out Caspian oil down to Karachi to the Indian Ocean. The Taliban proved to be, although we had created them, proved to be absolutely undealable with. Sandy Berger, who was the national security advisor to Clinton, they had drawn up a plan for a strike at Afghanistan. This is at the very end of the Clinton administration. The plan was all in orders, what they called contingency planning at the Pentagon. It was prepared. Then comes a change of administration. Sandy Berger says that he gave Condoleezza Rice, his heir in the Office of National Security Advisor, the plan, which, needless to say, if she got it, everybody else got it, because obviously in the Middle East, Osama bin Laden knew about this. But the general theory of those who are involved in these matters is that he was making a preemptive strike against the United States, whom he thought were going to attack Afghanistan and the Taliban, with whom he was on excellent terms.
That bin Laden was making a preemptive attack on 9/11.
Yes. This was known to the Bush administration. Condoleezza Rice has since denied that Sandy Berger ever gave her a briefing on this, which is totally untrue, if Berger is to be believed, and I see no reason why he'd be lying about it. So many lies have been told about this adventure or misadventure to the United States. What I do call for in my little book, and you might have mentioned, I call for an investigation. The president does swear that oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Well, that also means the people of the United States.
But you go further to suggest that the government even went so far as to not put Air Force jets in the sky to take action against these hijacked airliners.
Well, you put everything in such melodramatic terms. I say
really?
That is what happened. But, of course, we always claim that we were incompetent and we had bad information and nothing worked. The entire Air Force of the United States did not work.
I don't think it's melodramatic. It sounds to me like a kind of, it is a vast and damning suggestion. Are you being coy about it, or do you really mean it?
Of course I mean it. And of course I would like to see an investigation. And of course, the first thing that happened after 9/11, Bush called in the Senate leaders and the House leaders and begged them not to hold a general investigation because it might interfere with the war on terrorism. He did not want any of this investigated. Now, let's go to a specific. The specific is that the law requires, FAA, that within 4 minutes of a hijacking, fighter planes have been scrambled, which means sent aloft from the nearest air bases, and the whole East Coast is covered with air bases. After the first hijacking out of Logan Airport, your familiar airport in Boston, and then the second one, were duly recorded, no fighter planes went up. Then another plane was hijacked. This is the one that ends up in the Pentagon. And then another one ends up in a Pennsylvania field. Still nothing goes up. Now, the law is, and you don't need presidential order, it is mandatory. They must go up. They did not go up. Why didn't they go up? Now, this is well worth an investigation. And if we had a serious country, and if we had a serious Congress, this would have all been out in the open by now, and we would find out because this is court-martial time, and this is impeachment time.
Jack Beatty.
We were not protected.
Jack, join us here. Govardhal is doing more as we go forward than suggesting we connect the dots. He's starting to connect dots here. We read with respect and an enormous interest his whole critique of what's happened to the American Republic, the menace of empire and imperialism. Well, when it comes to 9/11, is it a persuasive case in your mind that you hear made?
Well, I do think that he's leaving out the room for mistakes, failures, ambiguities, blunders, blindness, ideological fixation. In short, all the forces that I at least think make for historical events. I do not myself subscribe to the notion, or not that Mr. Vidal comes out and asserts it, but he does approximate it, and he seems to quote other people in partial agreement with it, that in some way the Bush administration not only knew that an attack was coming, but in a certain sense welcomed it because it would precipitate a new imperial surge on our part. I don't go for that in this, for the same reason that I find, for example, the statement of Joseph McCarthy about a conspiracy so vast and so immense as to dwarf any previous such venture in the history of man. He's referring to the conspiracy in the State Department to give China to the Red Chinese. Well, I think there he's making the same mistake as Mr. Vidal, and I think Richard Hofstadter really did identify it in his essay, The Paranoid Style in American Politics, the attributing to the messy processes of history and even the awful senselessness of it, of design, making it, in fact, clearer than it really is, giving it a coherence, if you will, that it doesn't have. And I do think that if he doesn't come right out and sort of implement that thinking, I feel that in what he's writing.
Gore Vidal, clearer than truth?
Well, that's McCarthy is never a particularly good reference point. McCarthy, there never was such a conspiracy as he spoke of about the communist conspiracy in the United States. That was rhetoric for public office. This is fact. The planes did not go up for 1 hour and 20 minutes. That is a long time. During 1 hour and 20 minutes, the first tower was hit, the second tower was hit, the Pentagon was hit, and the hole in the Pennsylvania field was made. 1 hour and 20 minutes have passed. Nothing has happened. The president is reading to children down in Florida, getting photo opportunities. He's been told. Nothing happens. Finally, General Myers, and all this I have the record of, and I print the record, is at the Capitol having a meeting with Senator Cleland. And they're in an office, and out in the outer office, secretaries are watching these the towers go down. And the senator and the general are together having a nice chat. General Myers said it wasn't until they came out of the office that they realized that they thought maybe a small plane had hit one of the towers, that indeed this was a hijacking and a serious enemy of no doubt foreign nature had struck us. Then he says that is when he rang NORAD, which is in charge of our space weaponry, and the planes were ordered up. That story has been changed about five times since. Now, if you want the details, they're not difficult to get at. I'll send you to Time and Newsweek and, as I said, the Pinko Wall Street Journal for a lot of it. Meanwhile, I've done a pretty good job of just putting down the facts as we know them.
Gore Vidal, stand by. A lot of callers want to join our conversation. We're talking tonight with Gore Vidal about 9/11 and the fate of the American Republic. Was 9/11 all about oil and Afghan pipelines? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. John's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
I totally believe that our great country has been hijacked by the Bush regime. And there's a lot of people like me that believe this and would love to see an investigation into this. There's a lot of people who are caught up in so much fear that they don't want to believe the possibility of this. And it's my belief that they knew something was coming. They did not realize how big it would be. There are too many suspicions. Bush had paperwork on his desk ready to deal with Iraq, and he
had an executive order. Yeah.
So he had this stuff already in progress. This was already something he was getting ready to put forward.
John, so you're ready to believe, and we thank you for your call. Jack Beattie, I want to go first to you here on the issue of investigations. Gore Vidal is saying there should have been immediately investigations, an investigation, more than one perhaps. Does an investigation necessarily mean we'd know what's going on? Gore Vidal, as you read, Jack, in the same book, points to Pearl Harbor and says we still have not been told, at least at the level of national understanding, what really went on at Pearl Harbor.
Well, I agree that we should have investigations, but it shows the Bush administration attitude toward them that they put essentially a mortician, Henry Kissinger, a mortician of investigations, in charge of the investigations until Mr. Kissinger's prior financial commitments ruled that out. I think the next election should be about the failures of this administration. I think it should be about why Condoleezza Rice could assert, well, I didn't realize that planes could be, that anyone was going to hijack a plane to use it as a missile, when there'd been a lot of talk about that. Why Mr. Rumsfeld, with all his money and his intelligence, he really deploys most of the money in intelligence, didn't come up with anything here. Why Mr. Cheney, who had the anti-terrorism portfolio, apparently never called a meeting of the anti-terrorism group? And why Mr. Bush himself, whom we recognize as a man who does not ask the second question, much less the third and the fourth, why Mr. Bush himself didn't take in August of 2001 the steps that would have led to comprehensive and meaningful warnings to the airlines? I think all this does need to be investigated. It also should be a matter of political argument, I think, on the part of the opposition party. But to that, I say good luck. The prospect of having that from the Democrats seems to me infinitesimal.
Gore Vidal, you write about great myths that you say surround America's understanding of itself. What confidence do you have that an investigation would pull out the dots that you lay out here?
Well, I'm not one to say because things go wrong that you must not do anything. You must investigate no matter how crooked the investigators. Truth starts to come out about many things. Pearl Harbor was one, which we will not go into now. And certainly the truth about this, you know, we were warned in advance. Washington, the president, was warned by President Putin of Russia, Mubarak of Egypt. Mossad made two visits to say that there would be unfriendly visitors to our skies. The FBI, a whole group of them, tried to get word through to the top, and it was stopped somewhere in the Justice Department. And they were warned that under the National Security Act, these are the FBI agents, that they started spreading any rumors about there was some kind of strike at the United States, they would be liable under the National Security Act. This is a matter of record. This is, you know, I've never been a journalist, which means I do not give my opinions ever as facts. I have opinions, as we all do. I give only the facts that I can detect.
But at the heart of the facts you laid out for us tonight, Gore Vidal, was the issue of the jets going up. And my understanding is that there were two F-15s dispatched from Otis Air Force Base right after the reports of the plane's hijacking, that they arrived in New York about, 8:45 in time to witness the first plane hitting the World Trade Center. Too late to act.
I'm glad you mentioned that. They came from Otis Field in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. They arrived with no specific orders. Now, their story has changed a number of times, and I have a friend who's doing a documentary on it. They did nothing but circle around New York within 6 minutes, and they had lost speed, velocity, by the time they came down. So they were circling New York. The towers had been hit. There wasn't anything they could do about it. But they could have gone on to the Pentagon, and nobody told them to. So you are quite right. Those two planes did come out, but nothing happened, and they were not ordered to do anything. I'll say one thing, that looking for oil is better than fighting for, 12 years in Vietnam for nothing. At least our rulers are interested in theft. I trust in the interest of the people, because the world is running out of oil. And Cheney had a report prepared a year or so ago on the future of oil resources in the world, and got the dark message that the whole world would be short of oil by, I think it was 2020, something like that. So maybe he's looking ahead. Maybe this imperialistic junta that has taken charge of our affairs, maybe it's good they're gas and oil.
Gore Vidal, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking with author, essayist Gore Vidal about the fate of the American Republic and what happened on 9/11. He sees not blunder, but design on that day. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with novelist and essayist Gore Vidal about 9/11 and the fate of the American Republic. Was 9/11 all about oil and Afghan pipelines? Was 9/11 Osama bin Laden's preemptive attack on America? And are we driven more by scheming men or by brute events? Are you ready to fight alongside Gore Vidal to rescue the American Republic from the American Empire? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ellie's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Ellie. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm calling specifically to discover why it is that when something is so public as the behavior of the junta that Gore Vidal refers to, the project for the new American century, for a new American century.
The conservative group out of Washington that promotes a more muscular foreign policy.
Project for a New American Century. I have before me their manifesto, which is dated June 3rd, 1997. This was signed by 25 people, including Elliot Abrams, Jeb Bush, Dick Cheney, Elliot Cohen, Norman put Horowitz, all sorts of people, even Donald Rumsfeld and Dan Quayle, Paul Wolfowitz,
yep,
declaring their policy and the importance of pursuing an imperialist foreign policy. Now, given that, and given the fact that it's so public, or given the fact that they declared at that time that it would require an incident such as September 11th before they would be able to act.
But, Ellie, this group is not shy about what they promoted then and about their worldview.
Why is it that the press is not discussing them openly?
Ellie, let's put it to Gore Vidal. Gore Vidal, I think the press has written about this group. It's not exactly secret.
It's pretty secret. It's occasionally referred to. The press, look, the media belongs to the people who will profit from oil and gas and from procurement at the Pentagon. The media has done the worst job that I have seen in my lifetime, and I've lived for quite a while now. I have never seen anything so falsified so constantly in the interest of the junta in Washington. For instance, they did something that I thought was impossible. They've turned Saddam Hussein, a two-bit dictator, into Adolf Hitler, a world conqueror, which he is no such thing. But what they have done, and it took them about 2 months, and the media helped, to find a link between him and Osama bin Laden. Because we know they're all alike, you know, those guys. They're all evildoers, and I recognize evildoers because I'm a good doer. And we listened to the junk out of Washington. 70% of the American people, according to a CNN poll, now think that Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11. Now, if you can get a lie that big, you know, Hitler told big lies, but he never got one that big to all the German people and had them fall for it. Now, whenever I listen to this Hitler analogy, I think this country is so sick because of the corporate America, the media, the junta in Washington. You know, I am one of that very small group now alive. I'm a World War II veteran, and I served in the Pacific.
Enlisted at age 17, went to, the Aleutians?
The Aleutian Islands, yeah. And I certainly didn't think in 46 when I got out of the Army that in my old age I would see the United States going around the world giving orders to other countries, declaring that they are evil, that they should be boycotted, they should be invaded, and a president saying, I have the right to determine who is subversive and who's the evil, and if you're not with us, you're against us. This cretin in the White House is really can destroy the entire world, and that is why I am bothering to talk to you as much as I enjoy doing it. That is why I'm out here talking.
We appreciate that. Gore Vidal, put this in the larger context that you followed for many years now. You talk about a series of what you describe as myths that surround modern America post or the last half of the 20th century America right unto now. What's the large wave in which you see this all happening?
The large wave began with the United States essentially an isolationist country that minds its own business. Ambitious people become president, ambitious interests, banking, railroads, it varies from generation to generation, get charge of the government, and they often have foreign plans. We were maneuvered into World War I, which was basically unpopular with the people, but the people were not at all informed about the origins of that, and Wilson was eager to get us in. World War II is a very interesting moral question. Franklin Roosevelt correctly, I'm a Rooseveltian, by the way, quite correctly saw that Hitler was something new in the way of dictators. Mm. It wasn't going to be kindly old Bismarck beating the French yet again. It was going to be something pretty terrible, Holocaust time. Roosevelt intuited this and thought that we should go to war to keep them from conquering England and try to liberate France, which fell in the summer of 1940. Mm. 80% of us, and I was an isolationist, an America firster at Exeter, 80% of the American people did not want to go to war in Europe against Hitler or against anybody. Mm. Roosevelt then went in for a series of provocations that don't begin by how could he have done such a thing. I'm not going to bother with that question. I've answered it in the book. Mm. a series of provocations which led to Pearl Harbor. He got his war because the Japanese had an arrangement, a tripartite agreement with the Germans and the Italians, and everything came his way.
This is cutting off oil supplies to Japan, threatening to do so.
Yes, those oil supplies keep coming back. Mm. We had cut off the oil supplies to them and scrap metal, which they needed our scrap metal as they have no natural sources. They then struck us at Pearl Harbor, thinking they'd knock us out for about a year or so, while they would head for Southeast Asia and Java to get the oil, which they then proceeded to do.
Are you suggesting FDR was wrong in doing whatever it took to get the United States in opposition to Adolf Hitler?
I don't take moral judgments in these. He did. So we have to deal with history as it is, with what happened. Mm. He did do it. In the long run, it is far better that Hitler was defeated. Yes, of course. That the Constitution was skewed and that, Clare Booth Luce was a very funny woman, great wit, rather savage wit, playwright, congresswoman, wife of Henry Luce. Mm-hmm. And she was in Congress at the time of Pearl Harbor. And she was very much anti-Hitler and very much pro-England. And she said, the problem now, as she was declaring war with the rest of Congress, the president who should have led us into war lied us into war. Well, some of us don't like lies. Perhaps that is my New England conscience. I really hate lying.
But it's more than lying that has you up at night. It's the loss of the republic, which is at the center of the American treasure that you would protect.
Well, of course I would. And I hate seeing it go. I hate seeing the USA Patriot Act being passed by Congress without anyone reading it, as far as the congressmen tell me. And now, thank God, it's being reexamined. But a lot of it will go through, and there go many of our rights. Now, if I were you in Massachusetts, I would look up some of Daniel Webster and remember the attempts that you made in the 18th century to secede from the United States. I think it's time for Massachusetts maybe to go and just be a sensible republic and quite happy and break all relations with Texas.
There they go. Jack Beatty, Gorvidal points to James Madison and quotes his admonition that of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps to be most to be dreaded because it compromises and develops the germ of every other enemy, that is.
Well, Senator Byrd reminded us recently that it was Mr. Madison who also said that the war power is the worst temptation a president can have, because for venal reasons, for reasons of election, for reasons of political fear, he can precipitate war, he can declare when it will happen. And that sounds to me like a kind of moral X-ray of what happened over the fall with the use of the war issue in the election. But I do have to object to the picture of Franklin Roosevelt, or at least I don't have Mr. Vidal's knowledge of it. But my friend David Kennedy, in his recent Pulitzer Prize book, pretty well convinces me that the thesis that we baited Japan to bring them into the war will not bear close examination, precisely because the president had and his advisors all had the conviction that it was not Japan but Germany that was the truly dangerous adversary, and that Japan was a kind of distraction. And indeed, if Hitler had not declared war on us on December 11th, I believe, it would have put Roosevelt in a terrible pickle, because he would have had to deal with the issue of a kind of near war in the Atlantic, which he couldn't declare, and a huge fury against Japan. So again, I think we're making things clearer and more coherent than they really were in history.
Gorvidal?
It's not the Roosevelt that I knew. He thought and thought and thought. He was our Machiavelli. He saw that there was no way. He thought he was imitating Woodrow Wilson. All presidents have somebody they imitate, and he had served under Wilson. And the First World War. He thought that when they start sinking American ships, the Germans, Americans will get angry, obviously, and will go to war. We didn't. Mm-hmm. Pacifism, isolationism, conservatism was so strong in the United States he couldn't get anybody interested in a war with Germany. Meanwhile, we had been lecturing Japan, who were busy trying to conquer China, and this was the opportunity. And we began baiting them, and there's a book called Day of Deceit by a man called Stinnett, S-T-I-N-N-E-T-T, which is the most thorough examination. He was in intelligence, naval intelligence, in the Second World War. He's still going strong. And he knew the planners of this baiting exercise. There were 6 points, which I will not enumerate, but you can read them in the book, or better yet, get his book.
Govardhan, we're not going to solve that tonight, we know, but we get the point that you make with it, that in your view, it is possible, it has been done, that the nation can be led by the nose. I want to get at least one more call in. Ed's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just sitting here thinking of this commentary, of what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. And the country before 9/11 was vacillating. It wasn't going anywhere. So the country needed a focus. And what better point to have a focus with 9/11?
But does that mean, Ed, are you buying the notion that we invited the kick in the chops, the World Trade Center's destruction?
Well,
just for a pick-me-up?
It's just a thought that the country needed a focus, and this country always needs a focus. We lost the Soviet Union, we lost everything else, and we were just vacillating.
Ed, thanks for your call. Govardhan, just a bracing pick-me-up?
Well, maybe murder is better than suicide. I think that's what the caller means. But no, I don't think we needed that sort of pick-me-up, nor do I think that had anything to do with it. It's sheer venality on this extraordinary group that has got control of the government. And it's as though I wonder about Bush's sanity, that he wanders along making enemies everywhere he goes. He kicks the Germans in the teeth, the French in the teeth, the environmentalists. He goads, there are 1 billion Muslims in the world. That's a large enemy, and we're a small country. We keep boasting about how big and great and wonderful we are, the envy of the earth. We're just a kind of middling, run-of-the-mill culture without even a national health service, something that every first world country has. All of our money goes for war, which means, as Mr. Beattie knows, who's just been quoting, I think it was he, Madison, warning about the powers of war and war presidents, anyone who builds up the military, any president, goes to war. That is a rule of societies. The Founding Fathers, that was one of the longest debates that they had, was over should we have a standing army and should we have a navy. And finally Jefferson broke down, who was against both, but Jefferson said we need them against the Barbary pirates, so we got a navy. Now we've done nothing but make armaments since 1950, when Senator Vandenberg said to Harry Truman, if you want this military buildup in the holy war against communism and the Soviet Union, you're going to have to scare the hell out of the American people. Harry Truman said, I will. And he did. And they're still doing it.
And on 9/11, we were scared again. Govardhan, we're out of time, but we thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Govardhan is author of the new book, Dreaming War, Blood for Oil and the Cheney-Bush Junta. Jack Beattie, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you. A pleasure.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Tamar Morad, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Todd Brubaker and Fred Tice. Technical assistance from John Parati in Boston and Manoli Weatherall in New York. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.